The following Aloud podcast was recorded live in 2008 at the historic Central Library in the heart of downtown LA as part of the award-winning Aloud series presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Aloud podcasts are made possible through the generosity of the law firm Arent Fox and by individual contributions from listeners like you. For more information on Aloud, or to find out how you, too, can support the Los Angeles Public Library, please visit our website, www.aloudla.org. Rick Loomis has worked for the Los Angeles Times since 1994, and he's traveled the world documenting conflict and other issues in places like Iraq, Israel, Palestine, Afghanistan, Lebanon, Vietnam, Kuwait, Mexico, Haiti, and Cuba. His outstanding series on the siege of Fallujah and his heartbreaking Los Angeles Times multimedia report on wounded soldiers in The Lifeline have pushed the boundaries of mainstream journalism. "If your pictures are no good, you aren't close enough," remarked Robert Capa, one of the greatest war photographers of all time. Tonight you'll see that Rick gets very close and that his pictures are very good and often very disturbing. His many awards include the National Press Photographers Association Newspaper Photographer of the Year in 2003 and the California Press Photographers Association's Photographer of the Year in 2003-2004. Rick was a member of the LA Times team who won the Pulitzer Prize for explanatory reporting for their five-part series Altered Oceans, which examined the condition of the world's oceans. And he'll be showing some of that work tonight, as well as images from various conflicts that he's covered. The nature of war is elusive and resists depiction. Think how far war photography has come since Matthew Brady's work in the days of the Civil War, which came only 20 years after the invention of Daguerre's photographic process in 1839. Brady had to stage his portraits and his reproductions of static carnage. And his photos weren't published in newspapers. Half-tones weren't invented until the Spanish-American War. People managed to see Brady's photos through special edition books and galleries and carte de visite prints. And his photos of the carnage at Antietam literally stunned the American people. But his photos of the horror didn't make people any less keen to go on with the Civil War. Can war photography influence public opinion? That's one of the issues Rick and I will discuss in a conversation after his presentation. The great Vietnam War photographer Philip Jones Griffith wrote once that a newspaper editor told him to remember the five basic questions in every photo caption: who, what, why, where, and when. Griffith remarked, "It's the one in the middle that counts. To me, that's our task, to say why." That why is there for me in Rick Loomis's photos, and I think you can see that for yourself. Please welcome Rick Loomis. Why don't we start? We were talking about kind of the introduction about what informs your taking these pictures, and I wonder if you could mention something about the. Who are the people in your life who shaped your moral view that you carry with you, do you think?
A lot of it would be probably my mother and father would be probably the number one.
Yeah, you want to get it a little closer, I think.
Closer. Okay. My mother and father, and also my photo professor, actually, who was a preacher. I'm not a very religious man, but he was a preacher, and he definitely brought me to places morally than I think I needed to be. You know, he was a great photo teacher, but also just instilled me to do the right thing. And he was a photographer, so he taught me how to be a good photographer and how to be a good person. And that would be, you know, that's the number one thing that he instilled, was to be a good person first, and, you know, and then try to be a good photographer and then try to bring some change. So, and he's still around. I just saw him last week. So.
That's great. It's hard to imagine oneself in that setting. It made me realize why my father, who was in the Pacific War, never wanted to talk about combat. And I don't have any photographs or any images of, you know, I have his letters, but I don't know what it looked like. Ernie Pyle, you know, who was the great World War II correspondent, wrote about, he says, the outstanding thing about life at the front was this feeling of vitality, no mere onlooker, but a member of the team. And, you know, you described many emotions tonight of your own. I mean, fear and sadness, and I was looking at some of the photos more slowly today, you know, disbelief and camaraderie. But do you think that, did you feel also that vitality that Ernie Pyle talked about, as well as wanting to hightail it out of there? I mean, do you think that that can become an addiction for a war photographer?
I think there's an edge. I mean, I don't think I think it can be an addiction, that sort of adrenaline, to be in that spot when those things are happening. But, you know, it's also, there's a fine line, I think, that you don't want to cross, you know, because I want to, you know, I have things I want to live for, so I don't, you know, there's probably people out there who just want to go gung-ho and they don't care if they live or die, but I definitely want to make it back. So, you know, being in the spot where things happen as a news photographer, that's what I want to be. If I'm here in L.A., I want to be in the right spot. You know, when the riots were going on in MacArthur Park, it was right there. You know, the cops were shooting their guns, you know, with rubber bullets. And so it's like, you know, that's easy, actually, by comparison. So you want to be in the right spot for those things. And I think the main reason isn't necessarily to be there for yourself, but it's to be there because I represent the LA Times, which is hopefully is something that people, you know, turn to find out what's going on. So, you know, I feel an obligation to do that sort of thing, I guess, you know.
Looking at your photos more slowly today, and I was thinking about the difference between, you know, kind of being alone with them and looking at them in one's own time, you know, and then also in some of, I think it's on the KCET website, you can see your commentary on some of the photos. And one of the ones you showed, which is the man lying in the, you know, the hole that he dug, you described how you had dug your own hole. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, that was an odd, you know, right at the beginning of the war, we were in Kuwait, and I actually didn't think the war was going to really happen until they bust us out in the middle of the desert in Kuwait, and I saw all of the miles and miles of equipment. And, you know, once we got there, I was like, okay, there's definitely, you know, we're going to go to war. And we took off for war, and, you know, I had no idea what to expect. Afghanistan was just probably a mere primer for that. I got shot at once probably in Afghanistan, and, you know, in Iraq, they handed me a shovel and they said, okay, you know, there's gas, there's this. And these guys would drive, you know, we drove out. I was just assigned to an open Humvee with four guys in it. And we would stop. And, you know, every time we stopped, we had to take a shovel and basically dig a ditch so that if there was, you know, attack, you could lie flat in the ditch and you would, you know, likely survive. So I dug my ditch one time and I was laying in it and they said there was a gas attack and I had my gas mask on and I'm laying in a ditch with my camera. And as I'm laying there, I'm like, well, I'm really not doing anything. Like, I can't make a picture, and so what's the point of me being here? I don't have a weapon. So I'm like, okay, well, I guess this is the point where I get out of the ditch and go take a picture of the guy who's laying in the ditch next to me and then run back to my ditch and hope nothing happens in that, like, split second in between. So that's, you know, that's how that one picture came about.
But, you know, that's so counterintuitive. I mean, so much of what you do is like, you know, going into it. I mean, there's a real visceral quality to your photographs. I mean, there's that one of the three soldiers, and then there's this kind of, and they're holding their ears. So while they're holding their ears, and obviously it's almost, as a viewer, it makes you feel like you can hear this horrible sound that they're hearing, but you're taking the photograph. You're not covering your ears.
Yeah, born dumb, you got to be tough. I think that's what it is. No, I mean, you put yourself in a position where you want, you know, you have to document the action. I think you're referring to like when a helicopter's landing and everybody's, you know, turning away so they don't get any dust or anything like that, you know, in their eyes or anything. And you're the photographer. So if you're either going to turn away or you're going to make that cool picture of those guys, like, you know, turning away from everything and something that really sort of grabs you and puts you in that place. And, you know, I close one eye and put the other camera up to the other one and, you know, let the rocks hit the lens.
Do you think that your camera, in a way, in some of these situations, kind of offers you immunity, like it's like a shield, you know, in terms of your own emotion of what you're seeing? Is it like protection? I think it was Margaret Bourke White that talked about, you know, taking photographs at Bergen-Belsen in World War II, and she, you know, she said, it's like my lens. She said, using the camera was almost a relief. It interposed a slight barrier between myself and the white horror in front of me. Do you ever feel like it's sort of a protection?
I think some people would agree with that. I don't know if I necessarily agree with that because, you know, then you become sort of emotionless. And I feel like if you don't have emotion in your heart and in your head when you're out documenting those things, then your pictures can, you know, be empty. Or, you know, I basically want to feel everything that's out there, you know, as bad as it is, you know, as horrible of things I've seen. I want to absorb those things and, you know, hopefully in doing that, I can, you know, bring back an inch of that and put it in front of a viewer's eye and, you know, have them experience those same emotion. I mean, there's a lot of pictures of, you know, dead bodies and people in pain and, you know, some of the tragedies that people go through that, you know, nobody in this audience might ever experience, you know, but they had to feel it just a little bit for a second, you know.
Well, let's talk about a little bit. I mean, you've said, I mean, especially in your pictures of the wounded, you know, how easy it is for people here to ignore this war. I mean, we don't have to pay attention to it. First of all, what are the, you know, we can do whatever we want and it, you know, we don't have to see it. It's not, the photographs aren't in front of us that much. So what are the rules of engagement that you were operating under? What were you allowed to show us and what were you allowed not to shoot? What were those rules?
For the wounded series in particular?
Well, no, and in combat, yeah.
Like for the war, actually during the war, I thought they're going to totally put me in the back of the bus and I'm not going to see anything during the war. And I was quite surprised. You know, they just put me in a Humvee and whatever we ran into, we ran into. I was not with, you know, it's not censored in really anything. I signed a list of ground rules, which I think has, you know, grown exponentially over the years to what you can and can't do. I think if you comb your hair the wrong way now and you're on an embed, they can say, whoa, you combed your hair the wrong way, you're kicked out. So, you know, now the rules are a little bit different. And in fact, when I was in Afghanistan on this last trip, one of the rules just infuriated me, and I'll give you a quick story. I was getting on a C-130 transport plane at night, and this happened to me once in Iraq before, so I knew what happened, and we were getting on the plane, and I said, hey, wait here, we're going to have a ramp ceremony. And a ramp ceremony is basically what happens when a soldier or Marine dies, and they need to transport him back to another base so he can transport to Germany, so he can transport home. And so everybody, myself included, we're basically told, hey, you're going to be in this ramp ceremony. And I stood in the ramp ceremony and didn't shoot a picture. You know, I know there's been rules in place. I forget exactly how long it's been, but where you can't show flag-draped coffin or whatever, you know, in this particular situation. So I just participated in it. And the next day, there I found out I was on another base, a bigger base, and I found out there's going to be a ceremony for 5 bodies being transported back at the same time, that they all just died. And I was told by the public affairs people, oh, you can photograph this. And I was like, are you sure that you know the rules? Because I'm pretty sure I know that they don't really want those pictures out there, but if you're going to let me, I'm going to do it in a minute. And because I think it's important to see that stuff. And so right before the ceremony, they said, sorry, you actually can't photograph the flags or the coffins or anything like that. And, you know, I kind of expected that, and she figured out the rules. And then again, they said, you can't photograph anything regarding the ceremony. I was like, okay, well, now this is a bad thing. Now I'm mad, you know, now I'm really mad. And then we got out there, and they said, oh, wait a minute, you guys can't even be here. It was myself and a journalist, a writer, David Zucchino, that I work with often. And it's like, you guys can't even be here. And they had coalition soldiers from, you know, every nation. This is in Kandahar, Afghanistan. Every nation standing out on the tarmac. Big, beautiful, you know, very, like, touching ceremony, you know, that's very, like, respectful. You know, there's nothing gruesome. I mean, the pictures of combat themselves and, you know, after the aftermath of bombings are much more gruesome.
What's the rationale?
And this is respectful. And, you know, I swear every time I go on an embed, I'm asked to go photograph every, like, rank promotion that happens for a guy or, you know, any, like, anything like that. Come photograph the 4th of July cake or anything like that. But something like this, which actually sort of is newsworthy and I think important for people to know, you know, and people can make their own judgments, but to be, you know, withheld from photographing that, you know, that troubles me. You know, I think the most important photographs that have come out of the war in Iraq have not come from photojournalists. They've come from, you know, U.S. military personnel. Mm-hmm. The flag-draped coffins and the C-130 and the Abu Ghraib pictures. You know, those were important photographs that came out, and they didn't, you know, I wasn't there shooting them.
What is the rationale for not showing the flag-draped coffins?
I think, actually, I did a little bit of research on this, and I won't speak authoritatively on this at all, but I think there was, at some point, there was a picture-in-picture live broadcast of one of the presidents, it might have been Clinton or Bush one, on the screen on vacation as a flag-draped coffin is loaded into the back of an airplane, and some, you know, flack for the White House said, ooh, we will not have that anymore. And that just became a policy that's never been, you know, overturned, I guess. And
But you're allowed to photograph triple amputees.
Yeah, you can photograph triple amputees. I mean, a lot of the, you know, people can, if they give you permission, it's fine, you know. So, you know, I've done a series on the, like, the triple amputee that Louise is referring to was a story we heard about. And in Iraq, it's this one survivor. He came like a week before we were in working on this story about the wounded, and he came through the entire hospital system, and people were talking about this guy. Oh my gosh, this guy lost three limbs. He weighs about, you know, 80 pounds now, and he's going to live. And we tracked him down in D.C., and I spent a lot of time with him at Walter Reed, and then I flew to Texas and met with him, and, you know, and then we published a story about him, and he, you know, he ended up on the cover of Esquire and on an HBO miniseries, and he called me last year, and he's like, thanks for making me famous.
But you also said, I thought quite poignantly, that, you know, you really worried that in 20 years, would this guy still be showered with love, you know, and because you've seen what's happened, you know, to a lot of the Vietnam vets. I mean, people are living in this war with injuries that they would have never lived, you know, with in other wars because of the quality, you know, as your series with David showed, of the medical care that they're getting. So the problems go way down the...
Yeah, I mean, with medical advancements, they've been really, like, and sort of, like, pushed to the front all of this, like, really good medical care. And, the, you know, the surgeons and doctors and everybody working over there is actually, as from a medical standpoint, they are very excited because they don't have to ask any hospital to do anything. I mean, I walked in, you know, they're like, come in, we're doing brain surgery. And I walked in, and they had a guy's head, like, splayed open, and they were working on there. Like, we could never do this back in the States just on a whim. Like, we're just trying to save people's lives, you know. And where, you know, it used to be tourniquet was the last resort to save a limb, that's the first thing they do is, you know, one of these IEDs or roadside bombs, they put a tourniquet around it to try to save the limb, and then they worry about everything else afterwards. So, yeah, these guys are living that maybe in other wars wouldn't have lived, and you know, the medical expenses are astronomical. You know, one of these sea legs is like $50,000. And, you know, the Brian Anderson, the guy who lost three limbs, I mean, he's got to be the multi-million dollar man by now. And, you know, all that, I mean, I don't know how government's going to keep up with all that with 30,000 injured at this point. And the PTSD is just starting to, you know, creep in the news.
How about yourself?
I think I'm okay.
You think you're okay?
You know, I do all right.
You know, that one photo really got me. I guess you were driving to Baghdad, and there you said you saw this something in the road, and it turned out to be a child, and the child was still alive.
Yeah, that still bothers me. I looked at that picture today as I was putting the show together, and I don't think it was in there. No, I took it out, actually. Just a picture that really bothered me because, you know, there was all this, like, on the road to Baghdad, there was things blown up and bodies everywhere, and you just saw... You know, you were just exposed to it. And a lot of it, you didn't get to really sort through mentally. Like, literally, you're in a moving Humvee, and I'm shooting pictures as we're going. I never got to stop when I wanted to stop. I didn't have, as an embedded journalist, you don't have control. So, you know, I just saw what I saw, and I shot what I saw. And we were approaching a car that was blown up, and I saw something, a body, I thought it was an Iraqi soldier, lying dead on the side of the road beside the car. And as we got closer, you know, I noticed that it was a child, and, you know, and that this child was still alive and still moving, you know, but obviously, you know, not in a good situation. And we had just a whole convoy of, you know, vehicles just roll right by this child. And I, you know, I yelled into the driver, and I'm like, that's a kid, and he's still alive, he's alive. You know, somebody needs to stop, and, you know, and let's just keep on going, you know, and that's, I guess that's a reality of war, but it's, you know. It's just unbelievable and sad.
That was really very, very, very upsetting, I'm sure, to everyone that was there. I do want to open up to all of you. I'm sure you have a lot of questions. I just wanted to just ask a couple of more questions. One of the great war photographers of Vietnam era, I was really struck by this. I was reading his obituary, Philip Jones Griffith, who died recently. He once said, and they said this in a bit, he said, virtually the whole of society... Virtually the whole of society believes in what they believe, not by direct experience, but by what they've been told. We photographers are in this exalted, privileged position of actually going out to find for ourselves, and that's why we're so dangerous. Because we were there, we saw what happened. Do you think you're dangerous?
Oh, I'm dangerous.
Do you think that your photos can make a difference in how the public views the war?
That's a really good question, actually. I hope they make a difference. What I do hope is I hope they make people stop and think for a minute. You know, because there are so many diversions going on and you really don't have to pay attention. And you can go to the mall and you can go to Starbucks and you can just not worry about a damn thing in this world. So, number one, I want to stop somebody. And if it makes them think, that's good. If it makes them change their mind, sure, you know. But more often, I find that people see what they want to see in your pictures. Mm. If I go to Iraq and I photograph the wounded and how they come home and what happens to them and the guy with, you know, only one limb left, I will have about as many people come up to me and say, that is so bloody horrible. We need to send more people over to Iraq to kill more Iraqis who are doing this to our boys. I'll have as many people say that as this is a tragedy and we need to pull out tomorrow. You know,
well,
so you sometimes
it's the framework
you
people bring to it. Yeah. Well, you know, it's what people bring to it in terms of what how informed they may be. So, and it's also there's a there's something that's called the you know, the reciprocal, you know, in terms of how war gets covered. It's like I was reading, the less popular backing a war receives, the more critical the press can be without alienating its audience. The more critical the press is, the less support a war receives. The less support a war receives, the more critical a press can become. So there's this whole kind of circular thing. And I wonder, with the LA Times being so diminished, will we get to continue seeing your photographs? Will you keep finding ways to get them out there? I mean, is not everything you shoot is on there, right?
Yeah, no, not everything that I shoot is. And I don't know. I mean, I don't know what's going to happen, you know, LA Times specific. I don't know what's going to happen to our foreign staff. It is troublesome to think that, hey, this operation could be diminished because it costs. Our Baghdad bureau is by far the most expensive bureau to keep open. And there's not all that many people interested in going there, first of all. One thing is, I think there's it's people are tired. They're like, I don't want to see Iraq anymore. I don't want to hear about it. I think since 2004, I'm the only photographer that's been in Iraq for the LA Times. And they've asked others who've turned it down. And frankly, you know, it's wearing on me too. You know, I don't necessarily want to spend my life going back to Iraq. I think it's still really important to go there, but I think it's also really dangerous. And I kind of want to go when I think the story is worth it. You know, I don't want to like die over there going, hey, we're just going to run around and do some embeds, you know, and just go crazy. I want to go when I think it's important to go there, and when I find something new, like a fresh angle to something. I've been recently, what I've been working on is I've been following three high school students through boot camp, and I followed them through boot camp and through the School of Infantry, sort of a more personal view of three young men's experience. And one of them is in Afghanistan. I just came back from Afghanistan visiting him. Another one's going to go to Iraq here probably in the next few months. And if I get my bum leg fixed, I'll go over there and follow him over there.
No more footballer.
Yeah, I know, you know.
Next few weeks. Let's open it up to you. We have two microphones, so we can quickly move through. How about we start these two right down here, Justin, and then we'll...
Yes, thank you for your great photography. But my question is you had a part where it talked about the journalists that were killed, and then there were three pictures. Were those three journalists that you knew? I couldn't see the... read the text, so that's what I was just curious about.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I didn't actually get to screen this before, but those are... I've lost friends over there, I guess, and I just wanted to put up three friends that I had lost. One was an American civilian from Northern California who I became friends with in Afghanistan, who basically worked to hold the U.S. accountable for civilian deaths in Iraq and Afghanistan. And she was sad. Her name was Marla Rizikin, and she was sadly killed in a suicide car bombing on the airport road in Baghdad in 2005, I believe. And one of the others was Lance Corporal Aaron Austin, and he was the Marine that you saw in the video who I was carrying off the battlefield. He was that Marine. You know, I call his mom every year on April 26th and, you know, say that I'm sorry for the loss of her son. So that was a big one. And the other one was Captain Zug Zembek, and he was the captain that sort of got me into and out of my worst day in Iraq, which was in Fallujah on that same day that Aaron Austin was killed. And he was killed in 2006 in Baghdad. He was basically, you know, brought out of Iraq, and they said, hey, you can ride a desk for a while. And he just kept wanting to go back, and he was just a pretty brave and honorable guy. So it just seems like every time I just came back from Afghanistan. I shared a tent with a guy for 8 days, came back, got on the internet, and found out he was killed. So, you know, I've lost a few people that I've just sort of either just run into or that I've gotten to know pretty well. You know, invariably I'll just shoot a snapshot of somebody and never even do anything but write down their name. But then, you know, when they die, it comes back. You know, they'll be looking for pictures, and they come back to me, and they say, hey, this guy in Minnesota just died. You know, can you send us a picture for the newspaper? So, you know, it's kind of sad to be sort of connected to those people.
Yeah, well, on the lighter side, as a former photojournalist myself, I had some technical questions. You know, photographers always talk technical.
Oh, God, you're not going to ask me how many megapixels my camera is, are you?
No, not in that sense, but in the sense of more of the visual quality, and I don't know if this is... I noticed that there aren't really any bright colors, and I wondered if you did something to desaturate the images so they look more like black and white.
It's not my fault. Really, on my computer, they're saturated.
Oh, I see.
This so right here in the front row toned all the pictures up, made them look pretty. But
so it's not a choice. There are bright colors in your picture.
Yeah, there actually are. The screen was just it was a little bit muted, and we couldn't figure out how to get the contrast. We tried for a little while. Actually, I was late, so we didn't get to like really fiddle with it. But the pictures have more saturation and more color. But there is like the stuff from Afghanistan. That place is just so like monochromatic in everything. Everything sort of looks the same. So if you remember, I did a series of portraits of war victims, and I wanted to isolate them, so I shot them all on black backgrounds just because it was like that. Every scene just looked
the
same. And
that series, just amazing.
Yeah, they left me alone there with no story, so I did a portrait series.
Over here? And then if anyone over there afterwards? Okay.
Hey, kind of along the same lines, technically, if you're in a battle situation, how does that impact your ability to actually execute a shot, change batteries, focus? Does that? And what's your shooting ratio? Does your shooting ratio go up or down in terms of something that, you know, your ratio of good shots to bad shots?
Oh, I have a horrible ratio of good shots to bad shots. And focus has never been, like, a strong point of mine, but I try. I don't know. I think, like, you just... Sometimes I think you think about safety, but then there's a point when you can't really think about safety and you just sort of act and you think, well, I'm either standing here doing nothing or I'm standing here doing my job, and either way you're at risk. I've done some things that might be considered, you know, not so smart, but usually I try to play like I really am cognizant of everything that's going on around me and try to put myself in a spot where I can get pictures and also get out, since that's sort of like necessary. As far as like the shooting more or less, it depends what's going on, you know. If it's going on, I'm going to be there and I'm going to be shooting a lot, you know, to document. I did a story just totally off of this. I hung out last summer with the LAPD gang cops and ended up myself, a writer, and one cop. Usually there's two cops to a car, but it just happened to be the sergeant we were riding with, and we were the first people on a shooting scene. And it was Nickerson Gardens, like the worst project in LA, and it was at the middle of the night, and got to the scene, and there was hundreds of angry people converging on two bodies in the street, and I was scared to death and basically stood there and shot like probably 400 pictures, and you can find all 400 of them from one spot, trying to get one that I thought was going to be in focus and have a good moment and whatever. So it's just whatever the scene calls for.
Anyone over there? Down here? Just hang on one second. Hey, one second.
Rick, do you think you suffer from post-traumatic stress yourself? I hear a lot of guilt feelings there.
I'm sorry, what'd you say?
Do you think he suffered from PTSD?
No, I hope not, actually. I actually went to a counselor once and just questioned her, and she seemed to think I was okay, pretty well adjusted, so I'll take okay. I mean, I definitely have seen things that I didn't want to see, and those things will live with me forever, and I guess I'll bear the brunt, hoping that they'll, you know, cause other people to at least think about what's going on and stop them for just a moment. You know, it makes me sad. I mean, I've definitely, like, seen things that make me sad. And, you know, there's moments when I'll just, like, see a movie about, you know, Iraq or whatever, and I'll just cry when maybe nobody else in the movie might be crying. That could be PTSD. I don't know. Just maybe I'm just emotional.
Right here? Just hang one second. There you go.
Well, two questions. One is the incident at Nickerson Garden, was that last November with Hector Becerra? Yes.
That's it. Okay. With Hector.
Yeah, it's actually on the LA Times website.
Yeah, it's on the LA Times website. If you look up something like gang cops or something like that, we ran like a whole series. It looks like a movie from the pictures with audio that I did.
Yeah, and the second question, the last point that you just mentioned. So did you see the kite runner, and did that make a difference in terms of your view of Afghanistan and your photography of Afghanistan this last time you were back?
Actually, I read the book, Kite Runner, and I love the book. And the book, to me, I don't know if you guys have read Kite Runner, but it, if you haven't been to Afghanistan, like, it, to a T, like, I can visualize everything. And I don't think it made a difference in my photography, you know, my approach toward Afghanistan. Afghanistan has just progressively gotten a lot less fun, basically. Like, 2001, 2002... nobody even seen Afghanistan, you know, in a while, per se, like in a while. So every story was new, and, you know, I was just running around the country doing various stories, and it felt very safe, and, you know, everything was of interest and sellable to the newspaper. So we did stories about the Buddha statues in Bamiyan and, you know, cave dwellers and you name it. We were out there trying to do these, you know, pretty interesting stories from the civilian side. Now, in my last trip to Afghanistan, I was nothing but embedded. The time before that, in 2006... I had a full beard, dyed hair, wearing a shalwar kameez and a prayer cap, riding around Kandahar, getting stopped by gunmen, thinking I'm going to die. So, you know, the tide has sort of turned over there in my eyes a little bit. I know that, you know, I guess Obama was just there a couple days ago, and he was like, hey, we really need to refocus some effort over here. I'm kind of like, yeah, probably so. I mean, this trip that I was just on, they were literally orchestrating a mission to go back to this place called Camp Rhino, which is the very first place I sat down in Afghanistan in 2001. I was like, that is like full circle for me, and didn't make sense. But yeah, I think it's just gotten to be a little bit more dangerous place to work. But I love the culture, and I love the people, and I'll take going there any day over going to Iraq.
Really? How about back there? Justin, right there. Either one of those two.
I was trying to process your photos mentally because they're real exercise in contradiction. You have a soldier with Fuck Iraq on his knuckles, and you have Iraqi children chasing a Humvee with a smile on their face. You have a Humvee that says Remember 9/11 in Iraq, which had nothing to do with 9/11. So having been there...
I didn't paint that.
Having been there, how do you see these soldiers sort of processing what's going on before them with everything we know to be true and perhaps what we are getting the wrong impression here stateside?
Yeah, I mean...
That's a good question.
Yeah, I basically just try to document what I see. And you know, those, like the cheering Iraqi children, there was definitely moments when, you know, I was in a Humvee riding into Baghdad with the basically the top down, the canvas off, standing there, with the line of people on both sides of the road cheering Americans as they went into Baghdad.
This was early on in the war?
This was right at the close of the war, and I was like, wait a minute, maybe I was thinking the wrong thing. Maybe this needed to happen, and people are happy. That's what it seemed like at first, and you know, and that changed pretty quickly. I mean, I've been there a number of times, and I've, you know, things have changed every single time that I've been there, and the same with Afghanistan. You know, Afghanistan seemed like it was going up, and now it seems like it's going down. And, you know, so basically every time it's a little bit different story. And you know, yeah, the pictures do sort of contradict themselves. And in fact, when I shot that 9/11 picture, because I was scratching my head going, sure, remember 9/11, but what does it have to do with why we're in Iraq? So.
And the contrast, too, I mean, those healthy young Marines that are kind of like cheering by the, you know, they're looking for smokes, they have those signs.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And then, I mean, but to juxtapose them with your other photos of the wounded coming home, I mean, it's like it's, you're always kind of going like this, looking at these pictures, like, how can this be this, and how can that be that?
I mean, yeah, I mean, I think those guys, you know, I spent a lot of time, like, with these three Marines going through boot camp, and they, you know, they learned the history of the Marine Corps, and they, you know, they're, you know, sort of told, here's what, you know, is going on, and that's what they're going to go with. That's going to be their gut, you know, and part of it's self-preservation, and part of it's to make the unit work together. You know, they don't want a lot of independent thinkers out there going, yeah, well, you know, I don't think I'm going to engage this guy because he looks pretty friendly. You know, it's kind of like, everybody out there, beware, you know. That's their first lesson, you know.
And also it's a problem because if people have post-traumatic stress or they saw something horrible, this happened to one of the vets in my writing class, you know, if someone goes to the to get help, mental health help there, maybe it's okay if you go once, but if you go once, twice or three times, you know, it's on your military record, and also the other guys don't want to work with you. You know, they're very wary of you. So people are not getting the mental health help that they need.
There's definitely a stigma attached to that, and I think, I mean, you know, there's a certain personality that joins like the Army or the Marine Corps. It's, you know, this bravado type of personality, and that's not a personality that really wants to
seek help.
Feel like they're mentally weak or that they need to go see somebody after they've seen that stuff. And you know, the fact is that most of them probably do, because most of them see, you know, really bad things.
Back there, Libby and Justin will collide in the middle. You're right there in the front row.
You were talking before about you wishing to make people think, and I was wondering, I was wondering if you have some kind of a clear-cut message, like war is bad or we should be out of there, or do some of the pictures, do you think, convey kind of a more complicated message than that?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I don't personally have a direct message. You know, I think my job is to put the pictures out there and let you sort of sort out what you think is going on there. You know, give you sort of at least the visual, you know, audible information that I gather. And, you know, you can say, wow, you know, 30,000 injured and, you know, gas prices $5 a gallon and, you know, this is happening. So is it a good idea to be there? I don't know. I mean, I don't like seeing, you know, anybody hurt. And I've seen a lot of people hurt in those wars. So it doesn't make me a big fan of what's going on over there. You know, but my hope is just to basically be allowed access to those places and then just shoot images and show what it's like.
Thank you. Over there.
First, I want to say thank you for sharing those photographs with us. I have a nephew that's there right now, very concerned about him. I have a question. Don't know if you know the answer, but I've heard rumors that we are, the United States, building the largest, most expensive embassy in the world. Somewhere in Iraq. I don't know if it's Baghdad, Fallujah. I have no idea. Have you heard of this?
I think I've sort of heard of that, but I can't speak on that. Anybody know?
What?
The largest, most expensive embassy.
In the world.
Is it going in Baghdad right now? Yeah. I haven't seen it, so.
It's just a crime.
I did get to
shame.
Live in Saddam's palace during the war, though. That was kind of fun.
To do something like that. Thank you.
No, I actually don't know.
How about back there and then down here?
Two questions. The first is, you mentioned that you were embedded several times, and I'm wondering why you chose to be embedded, and have you ever been not embedded and freer to move around? And the second question is, are you aware of Errol Morris's blog on the New York Times website that talked about the Abu Ghraib pictures? I think you might find that really, really interesting, because he talks about how pictures are not truth. It was very, very interesting, very provocative. But I'd love to hear about the embed situation.
How those pictures aren't true?
Well, what assumptions people make about photographs that they see, and how things can be radically different from what's depicted in what your initial reaction is to a picture. That they don't always tell the story.
Yeah, I mean, I think as a viewer and a reader, you know, it's sort of your responsibility to get your information from, you know, various different sources, and you know, read between the lines on stories and look in, you know, look deep into pictures and think what's going on at that particular moment. Yeah, it's just like one slice. So I want things to be portrayed as just reality. You know, you accept them as they are. And, you know, we can get into digital manipulation of pictures, which, you know, I mean, at one point we had an LA Times photographer during the war in Iraq who digitally altered a picture and got fired, you know, on the spot once it was found out. And, you know, we try to be ethically as correct as possible and as honest as possible. Regarding embedding, I would love to do both. I've done both in Iraq and Afghanistan, embedded, non-embedded. Both places right now. Actually, Afghanistan is still fine. Iraq is still, personally for me, and a lot of people have different thresholds. You know, it's a little bit of a stretch to go unembedded in Iraq and just run around and, you know, do various different stories. Personally, I don't think it's worth it. You know, it's not a story that I want to go over there for and ride around in a civilian car and, you know, hope that nobody captures me and I don't end up in an orange jumpsuit, you know. Afghanistan's freer. You know, I flew into Kabul on this last trip, spent a couple days in Kabul, and then, you know, flew down and was embedded in the south. In 2006, when I was there, I made multiple trips there into the south in civilian cars, in sort of like disguise. And, you know, that felt a little bit on the edge of not being safe. So it's more of a safety thing. You know, I'd love to report from both sides, you know, but you can't always do that.
I think we have time for maybe two more. So let's, Eitan.
Good evening. I am guessing that the process that you go through, the pictures that you take come from one of three processes, either things that you're assigned, things that you would like to shoot, or things that come up. Can you talk a little bit about what your process is with your bureau or the people in the Times, the people that you work with, about stories that you'd like to cover, that you've wanted to be able to show, and how that came about and what the results were?
Okay. I think it is, just as a photographer, traditionally the role is basically, you know, there's reporters out there and they come up with stories, they send them to an editor, a photo editor looks at the story and says, hey, this one's probably would make a good visual story. We're going to go out and assign a photographer to this. So it might be a photographer who's not at all interested in the subject matter, you know. So at our newspaper, it kind of goes both ways. Like, one thing is if there's a story out there and it goes to a photo editor and it gets assigned, they know the photographers, and there's about 40 of us, dwindling, but 40. They kind of know what those photographers are into. I like dirt. I like underwater stuff. I like adventure, you know, so they're going to give me that. I've never been to a red carpet. I've never been to, you know, any of the Hollywood stuff. They won't assign me to that stuff because they know I wouldn't know a star if one slapped me across the face. So they tailor it that way. And then for stories that, you know, I would be interested in, like the story we're working on, the buddies, was a story that, you know, I approached with a writer and said, hey, I'd really like to work on, you know, this story. And you kind of like get people in your corner to do those stories. And then we approach our editors independently and then make those editors think they had a really good idea. And then somehow we get to go do something fun.
Rick, I'm going to take the prerogative, just one last question here, which is, you know, you've taken some extraordinary photographs of Iraqis and Afghanis in all kinds of situations, some of them quite formal where they're posing for you, some of them, you know, on the fly, but how do you gain their trust? I mean, what do they think of you, or what do they think is going to happen to these photographs?
Well, I mean, most of these places you're operating with a translator, for one, so you don't speak the language, and you know, there's a cultural barrier, and, you know, try to be sensitive to that, first of all, and be interested in that, in their culture. And a lot of, like, the Afghani stuff involves drinking a lot of tea and hanging around and you're with your shoes off and somebody's floor.
So you really take your time with some of these?
At some places you can, but, you know, the entire portrait series from the Afghan war victims, those were literally people, and this was right after, you know, not too long after the fall of the Taliban, and those people were on the street, and if, as a Westerner, right after the fall, if you walked out on the street in Kabul, you'd be 10 people deep in a circle surrounding you, just sort of like looking at you strange, wow, look at that guy, he's from America, and so it was hard to operate. So those portraits were made, me driving around with my driver, and a translator in a van, and I would see somebody that could or may not, you know, maybe a war victim, may have gotten run over by a dump truck, I don't know. So I would send my translator out, and they would get like the 5-minute story on that person, and if they, he'd come back to the van, and he'd say, this is what happened. He was walking with his family at night, got blown up by a landmine. You know, his two sons who were with him were killed, and I'd say, okay, I want to photograph this person.
Did they know that their photographs are going to the American people?
Yeah.
That's
they would
so they
know
were
that.
Compliant.
Yeah.
So, okay.
So they would we would basically rush out of the van with a backdrop and shoot a picture real quick, and then write down their story, and then there would be like a crowd surrounding us within a couple of minutes, and it was kind of like, you know, the moment was done. So, but now you can kind of walk around without a problem. Hmm. People are used to, you know, Westerners there right now.
I know we could go on a lot longer. I think it's really want to thank you all, and Rick, I just thank you for your incredible work and for sharing this with us. And you can see more of Rick's work on his website and also on the KCET website and the LA Times website. So, and there'll be more work coming. So, thank you all for joining us here tonight.
Thank you, guys. Thank you, Lee.
Aloud Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through the generosity of the law firm Arendt Fox. Additional support is provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, City National Bank, KPMG, contributors to the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and Donna and Martin J. Wolf. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and KCET. Aloud theme composed by David Ornette Cherry.